So what were you expecting? Are you disappointed? Let down? Frustrated? Maybe a little angry at God, or maybe you're just angry at the world, which is just another way of saying you're angry at God. I mean, are you depressed? Tired? Just worn out with the whole thing? Would you ever just think of quitting? I mean, whether it be quitting church or maybe your marriage or your job or even the whole charade altogether. Well, what were you expecting? I mean, really ask yourself that. What was it? I mean, I have my own answers, as I'm sure you have yours, and I've watched the answers of others get decimated right before their eyes. I have seen young, godly couples try and try for a child to have no success, or those that did even worse, to have success only to be disappointed with many miscarriages. And I have also seen thoughtless, careless people with no desire for children be as fertile as the Imperial Valley and to discard those children as if they were nothing. I watched a man slowly lose his faith for a year. Month by month, trying to dissuade him. And then his wife got pregnant, and there seemed to be a little turning of the tide. Here is hope, I thought. Only to watch that child grow in the womb for 9 months and to be born dead on the table at delivery. He never believed again. I've known a family that lost their father to AIDS from a diseased blood transfusion, and when finally passing the mourning period, to watch their oldest son and sole provider for the family fall from a roof and die instantly. I have seen people raise children, laboring over them, desiring godly offspring, only to have their hearts broken by rebellion. And I have watched others put very little time or effort into it and have the most delightful, God-fearing children. And it's almost too much to take. But what were you expecting? I mean, what are we doing here anyway, really? Ecclesiastes wants to look at these sorts of issues dead in the eye and not blink. It wants to ask hard questions, the questions that if God himself weren't the one asking them, we would find to be blasphemous or sacrilegious. And it wants to give honest answers, answers that we may not want to hear, and answers that do not often leave us any more settled than the asking. I mean, Hemingway rightly said, the world breaks everyone. And maybe it's broken you. Maybe it's made you sad or angry or cynical, or just lost and confused. If it hasn't broken you yet, just give it some time. It's coming. And this book understands that. I mean, maybe you're grieving for a world that you thought was going to be, and now you think is impossible to have. I mean, maybe you're starting to say things like, I never thought I'd see the day when, and those days are right before you. But this book knew they were coming. It's not surprised, only you are. I mean, some of you are just staying as busy and distracted as possible so you don't have to face these kinds of questions, and so you just go on to do the next thing. And this book is here to mock you and to let you know that it won't work. It's been tried, and you will have to face it sooner or later. It will tell you the truth. Things like, you know, the rules that you've been basing your life on, that you thought governed everything. Well, sometimes they don't. Sometimes nice guys finish dead last, and they stay there until they die. And sometimes the sleaziest are blessed beyond comprehension, and they never get their comeuppance. Life's not fair. Life's not able to be comprehended. And life's not asking you at all for your permission to do what it does. But were you expecting that it would? I mean, what is it that you were expecting? This book, because of its difficulty, has caused all sorts of interpretive problems in its time. It seems confused. It seems to say two different things out of both sides of its mouth. There's a lot of seeming contradictions in the book. It seems to say things like, you know, carpe diem, you only live once, get what you can while you're here. It seems to say that justice isn't here in this life. It seems to say the rules of wisdom don't actually work. It's so bad that some have, over the years, tried to help it by saying that, you know, the issue with Proverbs, with Ecclesiastes, isn't that the Bible is telling us something we didn't want to hear. It's that the author, for the first 12 chapters or so, is an unbelieving cynic, and what he's talking about is just a cynical, unbelieving view of the world. But thank God there are these last few verses at the end where another man comes and answers 12 long chapters of untruth with a few sentences of truth. But that isn't right. I mean, this book is true. The author is orthodox, as confusing as it is. But it's confusing because the world's confusing. I mean, the book of Ecclesiastes is a problem because this life is a problem. And yet, this book promises, or at least promotes the promise of joy, but not at the expense of truth. And somehow it holds it all together. So let's begin this morning, as we dive into this book, with what is certain. And the first thing we want to see is it's all pain. The book opens with this man named Qohelet, which simply means the teacher. This man is often associated with Solomon. Many people believe Solomon wrote this book. And while it is intended for you as the reader to definitely read Solomon into the book, it's highly unlikely that Solomon is the actual author. It doesn't matter in one sense. The author wants you to believe that Solomon is the one speaking, and he does that for good reason. He wants someone who had wisdom that surpassed all before him. He wanted someone with enough wealth that he could say, "No one was as wealthy as I am." He wanted to use an example of someone who said, "Not only did I have pleasure at the ready or available to me, I took advantage of all pleasures." He wanted someone with enough power at his fingertips that he could have used all of that power and still somehow come up empty. This teacher, Qohelet, has been to all the places you are trying to go, the author says, and he's here to talk to you about it. So, you know, you want power, wisdom, wealth, you want pleasure, happiness. He says, "I had all of those," and he wants you to know that he's climbed that mountain, and he wants to give you a peek at what's there once he got to the top. I mean, it's like what people do every year at these conferences. You know, people pay thousands of dollars to hear people talk about things that they probably won't or can't do, but still they go, you know, to the Zig Ziglars and to, you know, the Tony Robbins and the Oprahs, because those people have done what we want to do. And we think, well, maybe by hearing them, we will gain some insight and be able to have power for living like they have. Well, that's what Qohelet's doing. He's bringing Solomon into view and saying, this man lived at the pinnacle of life. He was on the top of the mountain, and he's here to teach you all about what he found there. I mean, think of Solomon, the Davidic line. No Davidic king ever had a larger kingdom than Solomon. No king was ever wealthier, either had greater power, more notoriety. No king indulged in more pleasure than King Solomon. And after Solomon, you'll notice the kingdom is divided and disheveled. It never gets back to this glory again. And so if we're going to see the top of the mountain, the only way to see it is through his eyes. And we want to know what he learned there. And the first thing that we learn is it's just all vain. You see that in verse 2, vanity of vanities. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. That word, hevel, in the Hebrew is used 37 times in this book, 4 times in that sentence alone. And you'll notice that it's doubled. We see this oftentimes in Scripture, you know, the Holy of Holies. What are we saying when they go into the Holy of Holies? There is no holier place to enter than this place. You know, there are other places that are holy, but this is the holiest of all. And so doubling does that, Song of Songs, so on and so forth. Well, hevel of hevels, he's saying vanity of vanities, it is the most vain, it is the most futile, it is the bottom of it all. If the Holy of the Holies is the place that we can't go into because it's so holy, hevel of hevels is where we live and breathe every day. And it doesn't get more frustrating than this. Well, what is it? What does it mean? But I mean, well, first, let's just say, what is hevel, or what is vain in this world? What kinds of things is he talking about? You know, I think as Christians, we have some things we would fill in the blanks, but you'll notice what he says. He just says, all of it's vain. Even the good stuff, even the things that we would characterize as the good things, he says, those are vain. I know you've been putting some confidence there, but it's going to let you down. Family, hevel. Your job, work, labor, it's hevel. Riches and inheritance, it's hevel. How about wisdom? I mean, that's got to be good. He says that's hevel too. It's all vain from top to bottom. And of course, we hear that, and that seems off to us, doesn't it? This doesn't sound like church, at least not the kind of church we want to go to. But here it is in the pages of the Bible, again, which is why so many people have tried to effectively remove them. The word literally means, if you're just to take it in the most wooden way, you know, something that is like a vapor or a mist. It's something ephemeral that you can't kind of get your hands around. You try to grasp it and it goes away, which is why you also see this other phrase. It's like chasing after the wind or trying to grasp the wind. It's a futile pursuit. You can't hold on to it. And so when it's speaking physically, it's saying something that you just can't grasp and really get a hold of. And he says that's what life's like. All the physical components of life are fleeting. You can't hold on to them. They won't last. They're fleeting. Beauty fades and riches fade and life ultimately fades. But he says it's not just physically fleeting or ephemeral. It's not just that can't be grasped. He says it's also mentally impossible to grasp. You just can't wrap your mind around it. You just can't make it make sense. This life does not add up. And so in that way, it is hevel. It's vain. I can't quite grasp what it all means or what God is doing or how to make sense of this world. It's incongruous. The logic that I think should govern the world obviously does not govern it. This cause and effect that we expect, if I do the right thing, I'll get the right outcome, that doesn't always work. If I do the wrong thing, I should get the wrong outcome. That also doesn't always work. I mean, expectation versus the reality of what is are vastly different in this life. Kim Kardashian is a billionaire. I mean, why? I mean, Jake and Logan Paul are both famous and multi-millionaires. I mean, what the hevel? I mean, seriously, how in the world is that possible? That's not how it's supposed to work. I mean, why do they prosper while so many others who do honorable labor and produce real help in the world? Why do so many who do that barely make it in this life? That's hevel. But what's interesting, the Kardashians and the Pauls, they will also grow old and fade and be forgotten, and that's hevel too. The whole of it, from top to bottom. But of course, the world didn't start this way. When God made it all, he used the superlatives. It's all very good. But when sin entered the world, so did this reality of vanity. I mean, can you imagine it? Before, you would plant something in the garden and it would grow and there wouldn't be a rabbit or a squirrel or a weed to interfere. You would build your fence and paint it and you'd never have to paint it again. You would raise your children and you might not even do very well, and guess what? They'd turn out all right. But that's not the world we live in. We all live a wearying, futile, death-ending life, and it's common to everybody. And it's all because of the curse. You see that even in the author's language, that phrase, under the sun, that he uses 30-some times in this book. Under the sun, yes, it's where we all live, it's life on this earth, but it's especially life as we experience it in this cursed world. This world that's under the curse, the Romans 8 problem. And notice, the world's curse for believer and unbeliever alike. Even the creation, according to Paul, is mad at us. I mean, the world itself is frustrated with what we've done to it through Adam's sin. And your Christianity and your faith doesn't make that common experience go away. It's not going to fix the problem. It's not going to make it where all the little Christian posters in the bookstore come true for you 365 days a year. You will, at the end of many long days, think to yourself, it's all Hevel. And you'll be right to say so. I mean, the very first time we encounter this world in a word in some form is in the very name of Adam and Eve's child, Abel. Same word, and isn't it interesting that his life reflects the very realities of Hevel? He can't hold on to it. He's cut down in the midst of his youth. And the evil one who didn't bring a good sacrifice lives to a ripe old age. Both life physically is fleeting, and you can't make sense of the world. It's just not fair. It doesn't work out the way it's supposed to. It's all vain. Well, the next thing he wants to show us is that there's also the reason why it's all vain, and it's because there is no gain. There's no gain. You see that in verse 3. What do you gain for all your toil with which you toil? The word that he's using is just saying that there's no profit in all of your labor. That one thing that we're created to do, you know, to work, to go about our vocation. He says, you know what, no matter what you do, whether it be in vocation or outside of it, all the toil with which you toil, it will come to nothing. It will never profit you. And what does he mean by that? You know, when you're running a business, they're saying, well, how much money do you make a year? There's one thing to say, well, we brought in $300,000, but if, of course, you spent $400,000, you didn't make anything. The profit is what's left over on the balance sheet when everything is counted. And the author of Ecclesiastes says, when the whole of your life is counted for under the sun, there is no profit. Everything is a loss. You can't have anything left over. There is no surplus. When in this life you have finally paid the man all that is owed, the balance sheet will show nothing remaining as you're lowered down into your grave. I mean, nothing in this life can bring that sort of gain. There's nothing you can do to change that reality. Nothing you can do to keep from coming to that ultimate fate. There's no magic pill that you can take to make life make sense, at least not forever. It's all Hevel because it doesn't bring any sort of lasting gain. And he undergirds this point of it's all vain and there's no gain with this poem about the fact that everything happens again and again and again. You see this poem beginning in verse 4 where he says, I mean, creation itself has shown our repeated silliness. Creation has been testifying to us about this judgment everywhere you look, no matter what direction or at what surface. He says, the sun goes round and round, and the words that he uses, it's panting as it goes. I mean, the sun is working like a dog every day, only to set, and guess what? He gets up, he has to do it all over again the next day. The wheel in the sky just keeps on turning. Says the wind, he goes from, you know, the sun that goes from east to west to the wind that goes north to south. He just says, it goes around and around and around. It can never find rest. It never finally says that it's done. It's toiling and getting nowhere. It says, and the rivers, they run and they run, but they never fill anything up. I mean, the level of the sea never increases. They just keep on running, and they never stop to ask the question, why in the world are we doing this? What is the gain? They just keep doing it over and over and over again with no results. Does that remind you of anyone or anything? Even the way in the poem is written reinforces this repetitive, brutal reality. Look at the language, sun, sun, down, rises, wind, wind, around, around, streams, streams, they flow and flow. The style of the poem matches the substance of the poem. Life is toilsome and endless and repetitive, and you don't get anywhere. So too man, he says. He's running on a treadmill to nowhere. His words are wearisome. You can write all the philosophy in the world and you still can't make sense of this world. You can't talk your way out of its meaninglessness or its lack of profit. Your eyes can see and see and you never say, I've seen all that I need to see. Now I know. Now all is well. Now I'm fully satisfied. Now the world makes perfect sense. You can hear and hear and there'll be the same result. What has been done is what will be done. And round it goes, and there is no way off what Charles Bridges calls this weary-go-round. Well, maybe we think the next generation will get it done. And Kohelet says, no, no, they won't. They won't get it done. History is doomed to be repeated. The cycle never stops. The sun and the wind show us that the next generation is going to be just like them. They'll get up and try to do the same thing, and they will be unsuccessful, which tells us something that we really, really need to hear. The good old days, whatever you imagine them to be, clearly weren't good enough, or we wouldn't be in the midst of the days that you feel aren't the good old days. If they were good enough to fix the problem, then how did we get into this mess? The good old days were insufficient to make any lasting change. If there was anything here on earth that could have fixed it, it would have shown itself some time ago, but it has not. And what's even more damning is we don't even remember history anyway. So if they had found the fix, we wouldn't remember them. Just like you won't be remembered. People come and people go, and no one remembers. And isn't that wild to think about? We have a picture in my parents' home of a couple generations of our family. And besides my mother always pointing to my grandfather, who looks like a little girl in the picture, but he has gone to his eternal reward, so he's not mad that I'm saying that. I wouldn't even have recognized him, and I can't name anyone else in the picture. That's just four generations ago. They're unknown to me, and that's my family. How many billions of people have lived on this world that go nameless? You'll never know them, and you don't care. Well, guess what? We're a part of that same number, and no one's going to remember us, and no one's going to care, and there's no way to leave a memory. You think children will do it? Maybe you'll leave some family legacy, he says in verse 4. Nope, that's not going to do it. Well, maybe you'll make a name for yourself, he says in verse 11. He says, nope. Even if you made a name for yourself, three generations will go by and they don't care. How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? Yes, and how many seas must a white dove sail before she can sleep in the sand? And how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. I mean, I wonder where he got these ideas. Dylan is using exactly what Kohelet is saying. He says the wind goes round and round, and guess what? People still don't learn. He says, how many times are we going to fight wars and still never going to solve anything? How many times are you going to, do all of this laborious activity and realize you're not gaining anything? I mean, and this is, if you can bear it, our life. We eat, and then we wake up and we're hungry again. And oftentimes it does not take that long. We clean up, only to return to the mess the next day. The dishes are still in the sink. We organize only for the garage to get disordered again. You get the weeds only for them to come back in full strength. You take in all the news only to realize that news cycle is never going to end. We vote and elect, thinking that this will somehow solve the problem. And yet we have to vote and elect again because the problem's never solved. We toil, but we can never break the cycle, because it's broken. And so when he says there's nothing new under the sun, he's not saying there's nothing novel. You know, electric cars, those are new, they're great. But he's saying there's nothing new that can break this painful cycle of futility. There's no invention that we're going to all of a sudden say, oh, now the world is fixed and all is well. We will, believe it or not, be going by junkyards 50 years from now full of Teslas. Those will be of, the same futility that everything else we have ever owned is. But that doesn't keep us, oddly, from keep on trying again and again to find meaning where it will not be found. I got an Amazon package this week that had a beautiful picture on the front and a quote from Amazon to me. You will never know what tomorrow will bring. But yeah, you do. It's going to bring the same old thing that yesterday brought and every generation before. And nothing in that Amazon box is going to change that, no matter how much it'll scratch the itch for a minute. Generations come and go, and the earth remains forever. The world that we were supposed to have dominion over, it just keeps on going. and countless billions of people are buried in it, who are unknown to us and unnamed, and yet the same sun that shone on Noah shines on you. The earth just keeps on going, and generations come and go and ebb and flow, just like that river that's never getting anywhere. I mean, it's not working. And your way of thinking is not working. That's what the author of Ecclesiastes wants us to know. All creation history stands as a grand testimony against us. You can't win here. You can't stay here. You can't profit here. You will be frustrated here, and you won't last. There is nothing permanent. And what's interesting is deep in us, according to this book, we feel that. We know that it's true. We know that that is not a lie. When we can face it just for a moment, it's almost too much to bear. So now what? We feel that discontent, and so we try to solve it by addition. We will get some new things. And the author says, well, that won't work. You can try to fill up your emptiness in a shopping cart, and you'll have to do it again. Or we do things like get a new job or a new location or a new spouse or a new car, and those don't do it either. Because nothing new can change the cycle. As Cormac McCarthy wrote in No Country for Old Men, you think when you wake up in the morning, yesterday don't count. But yesterday is all that does count. I mean, what else is there? Your life is made out of the days it's made out of, nothing else. You might think you could run away and change your name, and I don't know what all, start over. And then one morning, you wake up and look at the ceiling, and guess who's laying there? You see, there's nothing that can change it. So are you happy yet? I mean, is this... Why would this author be so rude, as one has said? Why would he kill all of our hopes? Or as one author says, you know, you fill all of these balloons with the hopes of how life's going to change, and the author of Ecclesiastes just pops them one by one, says, that's not going to do it. You can try that too. It's not going to do it. Why does he say that all of your expectations are going to break your heart? He tells us this so we might find a new expectation if we can bear the fact that God's not going to save you from this. Christians, we aren't protected from this. And you already feel that in your bones. You've already lived this life long enough for the most part to know that this is part of your reality. But we wish somehow it wasn't. And so we act like somehow we can avoid it, or we complain like we expected a different outcome, or we shake our fist as if God didn't warn us. I mean, he put this book in the Bible. It's not hiding from us. We may be hiding from it. But what did you expect? C.S. Lewis put it this way. Imagine a set of people all living in the same building. Half of them think it's a hotel, and the other half think it's a prison. Those who think it's a hotel might regard it as quite intolerable, and those who thought it was a prison might decide that it was really surprisingly comfortable. So that what seems the ugly doctrine is one that comforts and strengthens you in the end. The people who try to hold an optimistic view of this world would become pessimists, and the people who hold a pretty stern view of the world become optimistic. The author of Ecclesiastes is saying, you do reside in a prison, and you're on death row. But, you know, when it's Salisbury Steak Day and you get an hour in the yard, you should enjoy it, because those are the good things here. But if you were expecting a five-star hotel, man, you're going to be mad every time, even at recess, and even with your Salisbury steak. So I ask again, what do you expect? There must be some kind of way out of here, said the joker to the thief. And the author of Ecclesiastes says, no, not by trying the same old human ways. There has to be some sort of interruption, something new. Nothing here is going to do it. Nothing you do here will gain you anything. So if that's true, what should we do? We should quit trying to gain, would be the first thing. The author of Ecclesiastes wants to say, you should really stop toiling. If it's not going to come through gain, if it's not going to come through profit, then it has to be some other way, which he's going to let us know is gift. And so we close with this. Into this old, tired world of men, wearing ourselves down on this cursed ground under the sun, entered the God-man. He entered into a world of no gain, and as such, God gave his only begotten Son as pure gift to broken sinners. And that Son entered the chaos and disorder of this world, and it crushes him like it crushed all of us before him. But he says of that bloody death, this is the new covenant in my blood. Something new entering the old order of things. And after death crushes him, he crushes death. He does this new thing that eye has not seen nor ear heard. And that resurrection changes everything. It is the answer, and there is no hope without it. As Paul said, if there is no resurrection, what? Our faith is vanity. It's absolutely futile, just like the author of Ecclesiastes says. But Paul wants us to know it doesn't change this world. The resurrection doesn't take the pain of this life away. It doesn't change this age. You will die. But it changes the game. Life is still deadly. It's just not serious. Because new life awaits. Behold, I will make all things new, God proclaims, in the new heavens and the new earth. And all we need to do to gain it is, one, receive everything as pure gift, and two, die, which is happening anyway. And there is nothing, as we've said before, wrong in your life that a good resurrection and new creation can't fix. And that is exactly what God has given us in his Son. I mean, don't you see that Ecclesiastes is written to shake us out of our vain expectations? So we might say, if there's no hope under the sun, maybe I should start looking elsewhere. Maybe I should plant my hopes in a place that is above the sun, something that is new and lasting and eternal in the resurrected one. We'll end with this quote by Malcolm Muggeridge. For it is precisely when every earthly hope has been explored and found wanting, when every possibility of help from earthly sources has been sought and is not forthcoming, when every recourse that this world offers, moral as well as material, has been explored to no effect, and in the gathering darkness, every glimmer of light has finally flickered out, it is then that Christ's hand reaches out sure and firm. Then Christ's words bring inexpressible comfort. Then his light shines brightest, abolishing the darkness forever. You see, the realities of this life are hard, and we will see they are also full of joy, which he wants to point us to. But the hard things are to lead us to the eternal thing. Because there is no fixing of this world. What we need is a new one. And that's what's been granted to us in the resurrected Son who has lived and died on our behalf. Let's pray.